You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, January 25th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, David Dayan from Fire Dog Lake on perhaps the most important question coming out of last night's State of the Union. Is Eric Schneiderman, Attorney General of New York, selling out when it comes to fighting and investigating mortgage fraud? Also on the program, Jeff Smith from Occupy Wall Street media team, the latest ongoings with Occupy Wall Street. Of course, a breakdown of last night's State of the Union address, for what it's worth. Interesting story about that mega upload arrest that took place just following the failure of, or I guess the defeat of SOPA and PIPA. New York Police Department training its officers to hate Muslims. And it turns out that they knew what they were doing. It wasn't a fluke. We'll get to that as we go on. And just a wonderful, heartwarming story of two college kids who are really striking out on their own. Paving their own roads, almost literally. Of course, I'm talking about Mitt and Ann Romney. When they started out, they had nothing but a pot to pee in, more or less. It was a golden pot, but I don't even know what that means. Isn't there? There's definitely a saying, right, about that. I don't know what it is, but. I just want to expand on my feelings about Mitt Romney's pulling himself by the bootstraps. I got no problem with someone's parents paying for their college, or I don't care, paying for anything. I certainly was pretty lucky on that accord as well. But I think there's nothing more inherent in the Republican worldview than this notion of ignoring every privilege and advantage they had, which has got them to a place of success. And I think it's a pathology. I think Mitt Romney actually believes it, but we'll get to that later. State of the Union was a good speech. Wasn't great. You know, for what it's worth, President Obama outlined some policies that I agreed with, some that, of course, I found to be somewhat repugnant. And then a bunch that I was like, it ain't going to happen anyways. I mean, you understand that under virtually no circumstance is a State of the Union address in a presidential election year in this climate going to really mean much. But for, I think, the story that we're going to cover with David Dayan coming up later in the show. We're going to do a little bit of format break, so he's not going to come in for another 10 minutes.
But let's go over some of the stuff in the State of the Union that struck my – well, first off, of course, President Obama talked quite a bit about killing Osama bin Laden, or he himself did not. But the Navy SEALs team, I guess it was Team 6. And apparently last night, just before the State of the Union, the same Navy SEALs team parachuted into Somalia in the middle of the night and released a woman, an American woman and a Danish man who have been held hostage by Somali pirates. That's good. You know, I think the administration is taking any opportunity to do these type of things. I guess good. But in the, you know, it's very hard for me to get worked up about one man and one woman who have been kidnapped by pirates in Somalia based upon the fact that we probably over the past month have killed more civilians than those two with drones in Pakistan. I don't know, maybe over the past week. It's just very hard for me to get my gumption up. I suppose it would be different if it was my own family. But that's why we're theoretically a country of laws and not men or women, as it goes. But be that as it may, there was that chest thumping. The worst part of the speech for me, and if you followed the speech and you are familiar with this program, you would know it what it was. I mean, aside from the sort of the platitudes, I think at one point President Obama said, there are those people who say that America is in decline. And I don't remember exactly how he put it. But it was literally something that I would hear when I'm dropping off my six-year-old. And if George Bush had said this, I think I would have vomited. And it doesn't sound that much better coming out of President Obama's mouth, quite frankly. I think he said something to the effect of, anyone who told you America's in decline doesn't know what they're talking about. All right. Now, of course, he's addressing, you know, Mitt Romney and Mitch Daniels, who came on after him, who said, you know, America's in decline. We're going off a cliff. So these are just sort of political games that, I don't know, to me seem sillier and sillier as they go on. But I guess that's part of what you need to do. But the worst part of the speech for me, not rhetorically speaking, but from a policy standpoint, was the American people know what the right choice is. So do I. As I told the speaker this summer, I'm prepared to make more reforms that rein in the long-term costs of Medicare and Medicaid and strengthen Social Security, so long as those programs remain a guarantee of security for seniors. In other words, that's the grand bargain. I'm willing to put to cut Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. And then he goes on in exchange for changing the tax code. Now, here's the thing. There is going to be no grand bargain this year. The Republicans would no way ever vote for anything that Obama proposes. And so my annoyance at this is mitigated by that knowledge that I'm sure that President Obama has. At the same time, the policies that I'm about to outline that he suggested that I agree with, I have the same mitigation of excitement because he knows they're not going to be implemented either. But I guess there's some value in this rhetorically for his campaign because it shows that he's willing to screw over poor people and seniors. And weirdly enough, I mean, I had this conversation a week or two ago. I was having dinner with somebody. I didn't realize what his politics were. But I found out after the fact, after the dinner, because apparently it was somewhat uncomfortable. He, you know, I was asking him what he did. He's an architect, and I was asking a bunch of questions. At one point, he says, "What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I do. I'm a political talk show host." And he said, "I don't know how the conversation got so quickly to this point where I basically said, well, the fact of the matter is centrists, so-called centrists, they don't really know what they're talking about. I mean, ideologues on the right and the left are wedded to certain positions. I happen to disagree with the ideologues on the right. Very often, though, they're far more in tune with what politics are. If someone says to me they're a centrist, that means that they don't pay attention to politics, because they make their decisions based upon what essentially what appears to be bickering. I don't like bickering in my politics, so I'm going to vote for the least bickerish of those people." The guy goes on to, I find out later that he's in fact like a self-identified centrist. It was a little bit uncomfortable. And he says, "You know, I voted for Obama, but I don't like him now. Why is that?" "Well, because he said he would, reform Social Security and Medicare, and he hasn't done it." And, you know, my response is twofold. One is, why do you think that's a good idea? Social Security is going bankrupt. It's bankrupt now. In other words, you're simply reiterating what I said to you earlier. You don't know what you're talking about. And on top of that, you also don't know what you're talking about in terms of President Obama. So not only do you want Obama to do the wrong thing, you don't even know that he's tried to do that. But he's being stopped by the Republicans. Be that as it may, the rest of the dinner was still very pleasant, because he doesn't really care about politics that much. So President Obama suggested a couple of things. One is he called on Congress to toughen laws against securities fraud and strengthen the ability of the Securities and Exchange Commission to punish Wall Street firms that repeatedly violate the anti-fraud statutes. I'm not convinced that the Securities and Exchange Commission doesn't have this ability right now, because when they go into court and they want to let these fraudsters off the hook with just a penalty, it gets thrown out. That's what happened with this Judge Rakoff, I think it is, in New York a month ago. So put that down for a nice bit of rhetorical flourish, but not one that's terribly relevant. Now, we're going to hit on these other points later in the program, because he did offer some interesting tax proposals, both corporate and personal. He also called on Congress to pass an infrastructure bill. Not going to happen, but pay for it with the winding down of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. He also did have an interesting mass refinancing plan. We need to hear more details on that. We will talk about that as well. But he also talked about the setting up of a new commission to look into mortgage fraud. And that is what we're going to talk to David Dayen about, because the most disturbing aspect of this is that he is appointing Attorney General Eric Schneiderman as a co-chair to this commission. Now, if you are familiar with my program, you know that I have hailed Eric Schneiderman as one of the champions of investigating mortgage fraud and all the sundry fraud that has surrounded it. The question we're going to talk about with David Dayen is, are we witnessing the co-optation, the selling out of Eric Schneiderman? We'll be back after this. I know this for sure. I won't get out that door. But I've been in town for just now 15 minutes now. Baby, I feel so down. And I don't know why. I keep walking for miles. The city people, they don't understand. No girlfriends, they can't understand. Your grandsons, they won't understand. are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome back to this program. I think one of the hardest working reporters out there. You can check out his work every day if you are a fast reader, because there's so much of it, and it's all great. He is he blogs at Fire Dog Lake, the news section. Are you there, Dave?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, you okay? I know. I appreciate you. You've just rushed in from a trip to the airport, and so I appreciate you taking the time, because you have been one of those people who have been doggedly following the mortgage crisis for years. You have been following the lack of prosecutions by the Department of Justice, the lack of enforcement, and you've been following this deal that the administration has been pushing the state's attorney generals from picking up. So let's start with the news from Monday, I believe it was, of a floating of a new deal. Just let's start there.
Mm-hmm. So there was reported a breakthrough over this past weekend on terms of a deal that would give as much as $25 billion for efforts on foreclosure mitigation and also compensation for people wrongfully foreclosed. I think $1,800 checks, another $17 billion for principal reduction for underwater homeowners, also refinancing. There's money in there. And this falls along the contours of what we've seen. But the claim was that the terms have been set, and there's this big meeting in Chicago on Monday with all the Democrats who are attorney generals. The truth was that actually none of the attorney generals who were holdouts on this deal were there at this meeting on Monday, and most of them gave statements that they still opposed the deal because, for various reasons, whether it was just too paltry a sum. We have $700 billion in negative equity in this country, and it was a $17 billion principal reduction to that end, for example. It says it would help 1 million homeowners, and there are 10.7 million homeowners underwater. And also it would release far too much liability. There's also the issue that the last time that we did a multi-state settlement like this in the countrywide case, the banks just didn't do their end of the bargain. The Bank of America did not do the modifications. In fact, they kept actively harming borrowers. So for a variety of reasons, there was a lot of energy on the left saying, we have to stop this deal. This is ridiculous. We haven't done meaningful investigations.
Now,
we have not put together the right thing. Anyway, go ahead.
The five holdouts, Schneiderman in New York basically started the cascade. Cascade may be too strong of a word. Bo Biden in Delaware, Martha Coakley in Massachusetts, and Nevada.
Nevada's Catherine Cortez Masto and Kamala Harris out here in California.
And we've spoken in the past, and Kamala Harris in California got a lot of pushback from left-leaning groups not to be a part of this deal. There was obviously a lot of cover with Schneiderman, and let's just hold off addressing why it's important to reference the sort of the activist work on this, because this latest story with Schneiderman sort of presents some problems that are developing on that front. But so that was the deal as announced on Monday. And then last night, just as the State of the Union was starting, there's a story that breaks, an exclusive. Sam Stein has it on Huffington Post, and it's referenced, I believe, by President Obama in his speech. Tell us what that is.
Yes, there was a reference to it in the speech of a an arm of the Financial Fraud Task Force, which you would not be remiss if you didn't know it existed. For the last 3 years, there's been this thing called the Financial Fraud Task Force, and surely it's been doing very, very difficult and comprehensive work. So now there's going to be this mortgage origination and securitization unit as part of this task force that is tasked with looking into those two major issues, the origination of mortgages and the fraud contained therein, and the illegal securitization, which is the bundling up of these mortgages into mortgage-backed securities, selling them to investors when, in fact, the proper chain of title was not conveyed. When you when they put the mortgages into the trust, there was various fraud and the misrepresentations and warranties that they when they actually conveyed these mortgages to the investors. It's looking at all of that. And this is probably the greatest liability that the banks have.
Now, when we say, let me just so the people understand, and when we say origination, we're talking about the people who actually made the loan at first, which is often not those people who end up securitizing it.
We're talking about the subprime lenders, most of whom are out of business. I think that the reason that origination is in here is because keeping that jurisdiction alive helps you with the securitization investigations. So, you're not going to sue Countrywide. They don't exist anymore. And the same with AmeriQuest or any of these other subprime lenders. But there's a reason to put it in there. Anyway, the point is that Schneiderman was announced as part one of the co-chairs of this committee. And it's a five-person committee. I don't know why it is a five-person committee, because that doesn't seem to be the best way. It seems like an independent prosecutor is the way that you deliver an investigation, not a committee. But who else is on this committee? So we have Lanny Brewer from the Justice Department, who was last seen on 60 Minutes explaining and making every excuse in the book why it's so hard to do these prosecutions against banks, who was a partner at the White Shoe Law Firm, Covington & Burling, who actually created the legal underpinning for MERS. And I don't want to totally get into MERS, but let's just say they're massively conflicted on financial services issues.
Well, MERS, just briefly, is we've talked about it on this program very much. It was essentially the online version that supplanted that said to mortgage companies and to securitizers, you don't have to go and create a chain of title through your local municipal or county clerk's office. We'll just do it online. It's made up by the banks. We're going to save billions. And in fact, what it has created is an arguably fraudulent chain of title. And let me say one more
it's
thing
a
about
key element.
Let me say
Point
one more thing
it's
about
a
Lenny
key
Brewer.
Element.
Let me say one more thing about Lenny Brewer. The last time I saw his name was four words in off of a Reuters story on January 20th, which said, "Insight, top justice officials connected to mortgage banks."
Exactly. And that's Covington & Burling, and that's specifically around MERS and some of the other the services, banks and entities they represent. One of the other co-chairs is Robert Kuzami, who's the current head of enforcement for the SEC. Before that, he was the general counsel for Deutsche Bank, who was one of the key trustees in this entire securitization scheme. The SEC has not necessarily been a model of enforcement over the last few years. In fact, they were rapped by Judge Jed Rakoff in New York for continuing to give these settlement deals to banks where they don't even force them to admit or deny any wrongdoing in the settlement. It looks to me like, I think Schneiderman's earned some degree of trust that he's trying to, move forward the investigations on the things that really matter. But he looks outvoted on this panel. And the real concern is that this is a means for the very united coalition on the left who is opposed to a settlement to go ahead and say, okay, we got our investigation. Now we can do the settlement on these other issues. We still have this investigation, this torch that we can, hold up, and that's going to be our way forward. So it seems like it's greasing the skids towards a deal. Another point to that is the fact that another member of this panel is Tony West, who's a Justice Department official, who also happens to be Kamala Harris's brother-in-law. So, you know, the pressure on Harris to get this done is intense, especially, you know, if you have a family member who's on this panel, you have they're dangling a carrot of $8 billion of principal reductions for constituents in her state in front of her. It's the only state that's earmarked like this is the money that's going to California. So there's tremendous pressure on her. There, you know, many of the organizations in California have said, oh, this is a great thing, and that Obama's finally taking this seriously, and with this investigation, and you know, it just, I'm concerned that we have this kind of regulatory theater with this investigation, and then the settlement will be a blow to efforts at accountability.
Okay, so what we should be looking for is whether or not Schneiderman and Kamala Harris sign off on this settlement.
Yep.
And that's
now,
the first
I have
thing to
look been,
out for, right?
Since I wrote about this morning, I've been somewhat assured that there is political space for the New York Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, to accept this position on this enforcement or this investigative panel and also object to the settlement. If that's the case, then, you know, I don't see anything necessarily wrong with more investigation, even though it's tied in with the same people who didn't investigate for 3 years. But, you know, that's kind of what I'm being told. So we'll have to see that play out. What I have seen is that the activist coalition on the left that has been objecting to this settlement came out and gave unqualified praise to this investigative panel. And that's certainly damaging to, you know, the ability of them to hold up a front, the ability of all these other AGs who have actually been, you know, against this thing to hold up a front against the tremendous pressure they're under.
Right. In your post today, you outlined the email blast you got from Move On, The New Bottom Line, Campaign for America's Future, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that it is disturbing. The coincidence of language, the fervor in which it came out, how quickly, how unequivocal, all of that is a little bit disturbing. So the on one hand, we see the possibility that Schneiderman still has the space to reject this deal, and but may have more resources because he has access to now federal cooperation and whatnot that he could theoretically bring back to New York. It may help him get a bigger view of it. On the other hand, what we're seeing is Schneiderman being co-opted, and he, I'm not sure what his upside in this is, other than there may be enough, you know, who knows in politics.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he feels that he can leverage some resources here from the federal government, some different jurisdictions, some bigger subpoena power, more of a budget to actually do the investigation that needs to be done. I feel that he's probably sincere in those efforts. I just feel like this panel is, you know, in some ways designed to fail. And you know, you have to look at the track record here.
Right.
You know, there was a financial fraud task force for the last 3.5 years. It hasn't really gotten anywhere. And, or last 3 years, I should say.
It's sort of stunning
and
that there's been
things,
a task force. I mean, it's, I mean, I, you know, all I do is read this stuff on a daily basis, and I've never even heard those words. They've been...
Financial Fraud Task Force. Exactly.
They have been, it's like a super sleuth agency.
they're deep undercover, Sam. So, you know, it's hard to get terribly excited about this, but, you know, I mean, I'd be happy to be proven wrong, and I'm sure that the groups that aren't probably very happy with me right now are telling me that I'm wrong, and that this is a legitimate investigative panel, and that we're going to see some real accountability here. I'd like to believe that.
It does seem weird. I mean, look, you rarely hear of an investigative body that's actually going to bring charges. You know, it's one thing to have recommendations, but these are all entities that can bring charges, right? I mean, individually, most of these five guys, or four of them at least, are heads of agencies that can bring charges. This isn't like the commission that was set up with, Financial Meltdown Commission, where it's just supposed to send recommendations to the Department of Justice where they go to die, apparently.
This can be a prosecutory panel, as far as I can see. So,
but why do you need a panel? That's the real question.
Right, I mean,
it doesn't make any sense.
First of all, you've already had one. Second of all, with far less resources, attorney generals like Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada and Martha Coakley in Massachusetts have already brought suits in Masto's case, criminal indictments against LPS, the document processor that created a lot of these fabricated and forged documents. In Coakley's case, a civil case against many of the banks for essentially stealing homes. So, they didn't seem to have this resource capacity problem that stopped them from doing the lawsuits. Schneiderman's been great in terms of the optics of this and objecting to the settlement. He hasn't actually brought any cases. He's done some investigations. And now we're hearing about a further investigation. So at some point he has to put his cards on the table. And I'm not sure that this body, this investigative body, is set up for him to even do that.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. And listen, I know you got to go, but let me just one more question for you, because it's somewhat related, because this was almost a 1-2 punch. The flip side of this is that President Obama also asked Congress to pass a mass refinancing plan, which would go beyond any refinancing that could happen through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac-owned mortgages, but would be across the board. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, good luck with that. that's not going to pass. I don't know if there's even a reason to say much about it. It's just not really going to happen. And even if it did happen, I can't see how it could be anything but discretionary on the part of the banks. And then you get into the same problems that you have with the settlement, which is that if you put it at their discretion, they have not historically been a set of companies that has an interest in the consumer rather than an interest in their own bottom line. So it's a bit puzzling to me. I mean, there were a lot of things in the speech that are just sort of thrown out there. You know, send me an up or down vote on every single appointee within 90 days. Well, that's not going to really happen, but it's a nice sentiment. I appreciate the settlement,
I mean, that was the dilemma with with this speech. I mean, on one hand, I had a problem with him basically telling the speaker, I'm ready to do that grand bargain again. We can cut Social Security and Medicare.
That's not going to happen either.
So really,
I'll give him slack on that end if I don't have to thank him for this mortgage refinancing plan. That's
exactly the dilemma. Imagine if you were hosting a show talking about it, the State of the Union. It's like two bald men fighting over a comb. It's all interesting, but at the end of the day, David Dayen, like I say, the most important thing to come out of the State of the Union address was the announcing of this second task force, which hopefully will not be so sleuthy. So we will keep our eye on whether or not Eric Schneiderman signs off on this proposed deal that the Obama administration so desperately wants the U.S. AGs to sign off on, the state AGs, I should say. And that will be the first tell, no?
That will be the first tell, and we'll really have to look at what kind of liability is being released in that product if it comes to pass.
David Dayan, the news editor at Fire Dog Lake. We, of course, will link to David Dayan's blog. You cannot do more to get yourself informed about what's going on than to read his blog every day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Jeff Smith from the Occupy Wall Street media team. We'll get Jeff's take. I think it's – I didn't want to turn this into a cynics fest today, but what are you going to do, folks? State of the Union, during an election season, at the very least, I guess we can be thankful for small favors. It's nice to get some lip service. But that's probably all it is. We got to take a break. We'll be right back.
Had a dream last night, but I forget what it was.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. How can you not love Camper Van Beethoven? I don't know. How is it possible? I'm hoping to get David Lowery on the program, the lead singer of Camper Van Beethoven and, of course, Cracker. Talk about sort of like music online stuff. But
I find myself singing that song on a daily basis.
It's a fantastic song. But we'll rotate more Camper Van Beethoven through. And if you don't like it, I don't care. On the phone, Jeff Smith from Occupy Wall Street media team. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So let's start. I got this question for you. Now, you've been saying over the past couple of weeks that, you know, come spring, we may see a new entity or a new movement, or you've been describing Occupy Wall Street as sort of, the first of maybe a, you know, sort of the stepping stone to another movement in some respects. And, these things aren't predictable. And certainly the nature of the Occupy movement is not one where anybody can make a decision, a unilateral decision. But I saw a tweet by Tim Pool, who was formerly with the other 99 stream. He's now with Timcast, I think it is, where he said something that you know, those of us who aren't attending general assemblies, aren't in working groups, that I found sort of interesting. He said, simply because you have not been privy to discussion from Occupy Wall Street working groups does not mean people are not talking about dissolving GA. I assume that means General Assembly. Do you know anything about this? Can you enlighten us in any way?
Well, there certainly was a proposal to dissolve the Spokes Council, which is a separate working body that was created by the General Assembly. What you're describing essentially sounds like a sort of suicide on, you know, as far as the whole movement goes, for a General Assembly to basically dissolve itself as a way. I haven't heard that specifically, and I honestly wouldn't take what Tim Pool says to be that important. You know, it's sort of like you don't listen to Barack Obama's camera guy. I think Tim Pool's great. I think he does great work with the camera. But, you know, he's a young guy, and some of the things I've heard come out of his mouth have been a bit misguided. So I would say that's a bit premature. Okay. But like we've talked about before, Occupy Wall Street really, at least the occupation at Zuccotti Park, was itself a direct action. So the idea that somehow that was the movement, I think, is to not completely understand what's happened here. And so I think it's a collection of people that created that General Assembly, but also that continue to work in horizontal ways. And so even to the extent that that General Assembly has started to feel like a hierarchy, I think people have started to pull away from it to just start to do their own things. And that's what you're seeing is a proliferation of kind of side groups and ancillary bodies that are looking to make stuff happen by themselves. But what you'll see in the spring is you'll see a different kind of a movement, but I wouldn't say that it's, you know, going to necessarily be tied to something like the General Assembly, or, you know, even the General Assembly was a product of just these people coming together at Zuccotti and creating this direct action. So I wouldn't play too much into what Tim Pool was talking about.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because we're seeing all sorts of different things sprout up. And, you know, one of the things, and I think I mentioned this on the program last week, I had an opportunity to talk to a guy when I was in D.C. who is involved in Occupy Our Homes. And we were talking about Atlanta, because the Occupy movement in Atlanta seems to have been incredibly active in occupying homes. I mean, it seems like every week I read another story about how they have saved someone's home for that is facing foreclosure. And he said, you know, the really interesting thing about particularly, you know, he was familiar with Atlanta, but he says, you know, across the board is that unlike the pre-existing activist groups, Occupy is not territorial. He said, you know, the pre-existing activist groups, because they're institutionalized, you know, they get a little bit territorial about things. We need to be doing this. You stay in your zone and you do what you do. And he said his experience with the Occupy movement is that they just decide to do something and they go and do it. And they say, anybody who wants to join us can join us. And to a certain extent, that occurred to me as a metaphor for the movement itself.
No, I couldn't agree more. And so I think that really calls to the point about Occupy Wall Street being that we really support issues on a right and wrong basis. And so it's not really about who's like a zero-sum politics game of this group versus this group and everyone wants to get their advantage and one up. It's more about just what's sort of right and wrong in this society. And I think that in that way, we're able to plug into so many different types of things. And it's also the youth and creativity with which we approach things, I think, that makes people interested and want to join. There's so much about, I think, you know, we talked about it in D.C. It's that institutionalizing of any kind of a movement that just sort of saps the power out of it. And I think we're always constantly struggling with this idea of, even within Occupy Wall Street, if we're going to become a more, you know, well-developed organization, how do we avoid any of those traps of having an office and a hierarchy and a structure and, you know, turning it into just this mundane thing as opposed to what is really should be a grassroots type of movement and something that continue to just catch on and flourish in this country. And so, you know, I definitely think that at every stage where we feel like, you know, it's getting built into something that's a little bit more conventional, it's a good time to kind of disassemble the pieces and rethink it and try and make it into something else.
And is there any other news this week? Obviously, you know, we spoke midweek last week. People are coming back from Occupy Congress. I imagine also trying to get some rest. I mean, anything that we should be keeping an eye out for? I'd mentioned yesterday the big win for the longshoremen on the West Coast, aided by the Occupy movement. And, you know, let me just get your take on that. the, you know, you had the official longshoremen, International Longshoremen and Warehouse Workers Union, say that they didn't agree with what Occupy was doing, because Occupy Longview was prepared to come down and basically mess up the offloading of these of this grain in Longview. But at the same time, it was one more element of pressure brought to bear, which brought this union busting company to the table. And I imagine that, you know, there's restrictions, legal restrictions on what the union can officially do. One more sort of way in which Occupy provides some, I don't want to say street heat, but I guess it's street heat on some level.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the idea of being nonviolent is not really the same as being peaceful. And the idea that we can disrupt and create, you know, tangible problems, that's what causes people to act. And so if we can frame bigger picture issues into specific problems where people are like, you know, wait a second, my Wikipedia doesn't work today. What's going on with this? You know, that's really effective. And I think the same thing with, you know, disrupting these types of, you know, business cycles or work or whatever. It's really that looming threat. And I think we've seen over and over again now that in some cases these labor disputes get magically settled in advance of, you know, when we declare some of these actions. And so, you know, it may be unfair to take credit for a lot of these things, but at the same time, there's definitely something happening, and there's a wave, and it doesn't seem to be coming from our politicians, this force that's causing businesses and even politicians to bend. You know, I mean,
right.
Bringing back to the State of the Union, one thing that did definitely jump out at me, and I don't know if you noticed it, but it seemed like Obama specifically decided to avoid 99% and 1% by going with 98% and 2%. Because he's almost scared of them calling him out as being, you know, populist or in any way associating with Occupy Wall Street. But at the same time, it was, I just found it completely feckless. And, you know, some of those reports came out that there was an official Occupy response to the State of the Union. And, you know, I just like to officially say that that was really just some hack side group. And you're going to see this more and more. That tried to sort of step in front of the spotlight and declare themselves Occupy. But not only would I say that Occupy Wall Street would probably never even dignify the State of the Union with a direct response, because I think, you know, focusing on the politics and particularly electoral politics right now is what they want and is a waste of time. But Occupy Wall Street is really against any kind of hacky political email blasts or any
right.
of those.
I actually saw that. That posting and specifically avoided it because it's, I think, you know, the idea that Occupy Wall Street is reactionary to the president's speech, I think it's got it, frankly, absolutely backwards. I think the president is reacting to Occupy Wall Street. He may be doing so in a way that he doesn't want to be explicit. I got that 98% reference, too. I thought it was pretty funny. I was actually going to try and do the math because he was saying everybody under $250,000 is 98%. Is the 98%. That may actually be the math. But nevertheless, I did catch that. It was interesting. You know, I think... my sense is that this is just, we're in prelude mode right now. And, you know, the only interesting thing is going to be, is if Mitt Romney becomes the nominee, how much will President Obama pick up this rhetorical sort of gift basket that he's been given, by the change in narrative to go after Mitt Romney, or how afraid will he be of it? That's really the only sort of interesting question. And at the end of the day, that's not going to be as relevant as what, frankly, my perception has been, is what the Occupy movement's going to do.
Well, that's we're hoping for that. But in the meantime, one thing that is coming up on Sunday, and this is going to be an ongoing initiative that we're trying to crank up, is called Occupy Town Squares. And it's basically, the first one will be on Sunday in Washington Square Park from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Basically, we're going to try and recreate at least some of what we had at Zuccotti. So there'll be an info table and various teach-ins and salons and think tank groups, things like that. We're just going to bring it all in the morning, set up everything, and then at the end of the day, take it home. And then try and do that in various spaces, both public and private spaces, indoor and out, throughout the city and other places through the winter as a way to just sort of extend, I think, what so many people thought was such a valuable part of Occupy. It was just coming down in person and talking to people. It was really such an asset to the city. It's a shame that Bloomberg was so intimidated by it. But that's what we're going to have going forward. But this Sunday is the first. And then there's also a bus trip that's getting underway, the OccuTrip that's going to go through New England, up to Boston, Providence, Northampton, Poughkeepsie, and then down through Albany, Rochester, Ithaca, and Buffalo, and then into western Pennsylvania, Erie, Pittsburgh, down into Philly, Newark, and then back up to New York. So overall, it's about 1,700 miles. And in each stage, we're going to kind of meet with local groups, local occupies in all these local cities, do some teach-ins, create contacts, that sort of thing, and even plan some direct actions in each one of those smaller towns. So it's, you know, starting to do some of
when
the...
When is that bus taking off?
It is on the 25th of January is the first leg, and it leaves from New York. And it's broken up into five legs, so there's 5 weeks. So you'll have different people...
Wait, the 25th of January is today.
Sorry, that's is that right?
I'm pretty sure it's the 25th today.
Dude,
you missed the bus.
No. Well, I'm not on the first week. And actually, yeah, you're right. Today is the first week. I'm joining on the third week, February 5th through 12th. I'll be in Albany, Ithaca, Syracuse, Rochester.
Great.
And,
well,
so I'll definitely.
Where's
the
URL? Is there a URL we can link to for this?
I'll have to track that down. I'm not sure I have like just back.
All right. Well, we'll put it on majority.fm and let's touch base because I'd love to talk to somebody on that bus. Obviously, you'll be on it in a week or so. But we'll touch base.
Hook you up with that. And I think it's great for people in some of these smaller towns to really
that sounds
connect
great
with people. So
that sounds great. All right, Jeff Smith from Occupy Wall Street media team, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Tim. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, that is I've done it again. Yesterday, I'm freaking out because we can't get ads placed, even though we have the numbers, but apparently left-wing politics doesn't inspire corporations to support us. And so I'm freaking out because we don't have enough members. And then today I come back by giving an extra 12 minutes. Bad businessman. I need some lessons from Mitt Romney. Now, when we come back in our better half of our program, I'm going to talk about that lesson from Mitt Romney. Also, the story of Mega Upload, which I was shocked to find out is one of the like top 10, top 20 visited sites in the world. In the world, they have 18 million registered members. And they were about to start a competitor to iTunes and Amazon. And then they got raided and arrested. Also, an update on this New York Police Department anti-Muslim movie. New York's police chief, starring role. Is he up for an Academy Award? We'll talk about that afterwards. So join me in the better half of the program. You can call in at 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. We need your membership to keep this program alive. You can also, if you buy junk through Amazon, go to our site, click on Support the Show. You'll see our Amazon link. Click it, bookmark it. Whenever you buy junk from Amazon, we get a little kickback. Buy your coffee at justcoffee.coop. Fair trade, coffee, tea, chocolate. 10% discount using the coupon code MAJORITY. We got merch. Give us a recommendation on iTunes or review. But all of those deeds... a single membership that you purchase is worth all of those deeds. I'm paraphrasing, I think, the Talmud. I mean, not word for word. All right, folks. See you in the better half of the program.